Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
The online seller Amazon has announced a list of 20 possible places where the company might build a second headquarters. Included on the list is the city of Toronto in the Canadian province of Ontario. Amazon expects the new headquarters, which Amazon calls HQ2, to employ 50,000 people. Amazon estimated that over the next 10 to 15 years, HQ2 will generate jobs that average over $100,000 in yearly pay. Thursday's announcement comes 4 months after the company first started accepting bids. The list, which was cut down from a total of 238 areas, includes major cities such as Chicago, New York City, and Washington, D.C. Smaller cities such as Raleigh, North Carolina, and Columbus, Ohio, were also included. In the Northeast, Boston, Newark, New Jersey, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh were selected as possible choices. Montgomery County, Maryland, and Northern Virginia, and the southern cities of Atlanta, Austin, and Dallas, Texas, Nashville, Tennessee, and Miami are up for consideration. Toronto was the only place chosen outside of the U.S. Los Angeles was the only city on the West Coast, and Indianapolis was the only city in the Midwest. Amazon's main headquarters is in Seattle, Washington. Amazon's announcement marks the beginning of a competition between the bidders. HQ2 is expected to bring in billions of dollars in both revenue and secondary investment. Amazon's plan for expansion shows the influence technology companies have on the economy. On Wednesday, technology company Apple announced plans to create thousands of jobs and build a new campus. Some of the competing bidders have publicly announced their plans to provide Amazon with billions of dollars in reduced taxes if they are chosen. Jason Larry, the mayor of Stonecrest, Georgia, near Atlanta, has proposed using 140 hectares of land in his town to create a new city he called Amazon. Larry said Amazon's chief executive officer, Jeff Bezos, can be the city's mayor for life. Amazon officials say they expect to make a decision sometime this year. The company plans to hold discussions with all 20 bidders about the project. I'm Mario Ritter.
Traffic accidents that result in deaths are individual tragedies that also hurt a country's economy. A new report from the World Bank says these deaths are a barrier to economic growth in developing countries. The report is one of several reports showing that investing in road safety in low- and middle-income countries could raise national incomes. Worldwide, about 1.25 million people die in traffic accidents each year. The report says about 90% of those deaths happen in developing countries. But World Bank transportation expert Dipan Bose says the issue does not get enough attention. He told VOA, "There is not a lot of political will in many low- and middle-income countries to take definitive action to reduce road deaths and injuries." Bose helped write one report that studied five countries: China, India, Thailand, the Philippines, and Tanzania. The study used economic models to suggest what each country's economy would gain over a 24-year period if traffic deaths were reduced by half. He says the results were surprising. For example, Thailand's high rates of both economic growth and traffic accidents mean that it would have the most to gain. The study suggests that Thailand would increase national incomes by 22% if it cut traffic deaths. This kind of economic growth is something no national government can ignore, said Bose. His report gives the economic story of why it is important to take strong actions on road safety. But another report from the World Bank and the World Resources Institute suggests drivers are only partly responsible for traffic deaths. It says that city planners and government officials are responsible for building safety into their transportation systems. Anna Bray Sharpin is with the World Resources Institute and helped write the report. She told VOA, "If the system's not safe, if people don't have the opportunity to cross the road safely or drive in a safe vehicle, then a small error can result in a fatality." For example, she said, many city planners use the same design rules for small streets and highways. Wide roads are designed for the greatest possible traffic flow and speed. They are not designed for people riding bicycles or walking. She says people often take risks to try and cross the road. And that comes back to this issue of whether this is a personal responsibility or a co-responsibility between governments and planners and people using the road, she added. The report offers suggestions for designing safer roads and reducing accidents. Public transportation, walking, and biking reduce the number of cars on the road and the number of accidents. I'm Pete Musto.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. In parts of India, it is not uncommon to see people wearing a mask over their nose and mouth. The capital, New Delhi, has some of the world's dirtiest air. The pollution was a call for action for researchers at the Indian Institute of Technology, Delhi. A team from that university has developed an alternative method to help people guard against heavy air pollution the researchers invented a small respiratory filter that is placed in the nose. The device is designed to stop most dust and air pollutants from entering the body without restricting breathing. On its website, America's Environmental Protection Agency defines particulate matter as a mixture of solid particles and liquid droplets found in the air. Doctors say that extremely small particulate matter, called PM2.5, cause the most severe damage to lungs. The invention, called nasofilters, won the Indian President's National Startups Award in May 2017. It was also named in South Korea's 2017 list of the top 50 technical startups in the world. The idea of nasal filters is not new. Some filters are available in Western countries to help allergy sufferers. They experience a physical reaction after breathing or touching something that is harmless to most people. One study completed in 2016 looked at a nasal filter made in Denmark. It found that the product reduced signs of an allergic reaction, and it was easy to use. The Indian nose filter, however, was created to deal with air pollution. In New Delhi, pollution from vehicles, dust from building projects, and the burning of waste combine to make air quality levels rise to 30 times the safe limit in winter weather. The filter is shaped like a fingernail. The dark brown cover is made of millions of small-sized holes and looks like a fine cloth. The inventors wanted to make something effective, easy to use, and affordable. The filter costs about 16 cents. It works for about 8 hours, and researchers say it can remove about 95% of the pollutants. Pratik Sharma is one of the inventors. He started working on the device with others after he was admitted as a student at the Indian Institute of Technology. Why did he get involved? His mother suffers from asthma. Sharma says the story of nasofilter began about 10 years ago. He noticed that his mother was always wearing some kind of cloth on her face. But she would not wear a face mask when she left home. So he wanted to find another solution for her. He says the air pollution problem is big, but the nasofilter is small. He explains that the product is easy to wear and doesn't look bad. On days when Indian officials say air pollution is severe, doctors advise people against outdoor activities. This is especially the case with children and older adults. But many people cannot or don't want to stay indoors. And they may not want to wear a face mask. This may make the new nose filters popular with Indian consumers. A retired army officer who lives in Delhi read about the nose filters in a newspaper. He and his wife traveled to the Indian Institute of Technology to learn more. He describes himself and his wife as outdoor people. He says the nose filter is an excellent idea. It's comfortable, doesn't look bad, and works. While products like nasofilter may help people breathe easier, environmental activists note the need to deal with issues causing the air pollution in the first place. The World Health Organization lists 9 other Indian cities on its list of the world's 20 most polluted cities. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the election of Martin Van Buren as the 8th President of the United States. Van Buren had served as President Andrew Jackson's Secretary of State and later his Vice President. Jackson asked his political party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. The Whig Party was against him, but their opposition was divided. Van Buren won the election easily. Jackson stood beside Van Buren as the new president was sworn in at the Capitol building in Washington. Physically, the two men were very different. Jackson was tall, with long white hair that flowed back over his head. Jackson's health had been poor during the last few months he spent in the White House. He seemed tired. There was almost no color in his face. Van Buren was much shorter than Jackson and had much less hair. His eyes were brighter than those of the old man next to him. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren noted that he was the first American born after the Revolution to become President of the United States. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His family was Dutch. Van Buren said he felt he belonged to a later age. He called for more unity among Democrats of the North and South. He said better times were ahead for the country. Martin Van Buren had a poor education as a boy. He went to school only for a few years. His father was a farmer and hotel keeper at a small town in New York State. Politicians, including Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, had sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them and others, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended tenants and renters who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official and then a senator and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with. But she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with 4 sons.
And after that, he was known as quite charming among the ladies, as they said in those days.
Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. Mr. Silby says most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his political life and his social life separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. But he did not have a national reputation like Andrew Jackson had.
What he was known for and what got him into the vice presidency and then the presidency was that he was Jackson's right-hand man.
Van Buren had been president for just a few days when an economic crisis struck the country. The crisis had been building for months. It really began with the death of the Bank of the United States more than a year before. The bank had been so strong that it was able to control the economy throughout most of the country. It also helped control smaller state banks. It refused to accept the notes or paper money of these banks unless the state banks could exchange the paper for gold or silver money. President Jackson had opposed the Bank of the United States. He vetoed a bill that would have continued it. After the powerful bank closed, a number of new state banks opened. All of them produced large amounts of paper money, many times the amount they could exchange for gold or silver. Business speculators used much of this paper money to buy land from the government. These men bought the land, held it for a while, then sold it for more than they paid. The government soon found itself with millions of dollars of paper money of questionable value. To stop these activities, Jackson had ordered only gold or silver payments for government land. But many banks did not have enough gold to cover the paper notes. At the same time, American agriculture was having trouble. In 1835 and 1837, many crops failed. American traders had to import farm products from Europe, and they had to pay for them in gold or silver. In the spring of 1837, just as Martin Van Buren was taking office, the demand on banks for gold and silver grew too heavy. The banks stopped honoring their promises to exchange their paper money for gold. They said the suspension was just temporary, that it was necessary to stop for a while all payments in gold or silver. The crisis became worse. Many of the weaker state banks closed. Those that stayed open had almost no money to lend. Businessmen could not pay back money they owed the banks, and they could not get loans to keep their businesses open. Many factories closed. Great numbers of people were out of work, and prices rose higher and higher. Most people struggled to buy food and other necessities. The price of flour and meat doubled between 1835 and 1837. Even coal, the fuel people used to heat their homes, cost two times as much. Violence finally broke out at a protest meeting in New York City. Some in the crowd demanded action against the rich traders. About 1,000 people marched to a store, forced their way into it, and destroyed large amounts of flour and grain. Businessmen blamed the government for the economic depression. They said the biggest reason was a decision former President Jackson made. Jackson's order required the government to accept only gold or silver for government land. Opponents said the order had caused fear and mistrust. Even some of Jackson's strongest supporters said it should be lifted. They said the measure had done its job of ending land speculation. Now, they said, it was hurting the economy. Two of President Van Buren's closest advisors urged him to continue the order. Lifting it, they argued, would flood the federal government with worthless paper money. Van Buren was troubled. The federal government had already lost $9 million because of bank failures. The president wanted to make sure the government had enough money. And he wanted this money safe until needed. Yet he did not believe the federal government had the responsibility for ending the Depression. And historian Joel Silby says Van Buren did not believe the government had the right to interfere in any way with private business.
He said that over and over again, that the federal government doesn't have the power to do this.
Mr. Silby adds that Van Buren's political philosophy grew out of the beliefs of former President Thomas Jefferson. All of his life, Van Buren claimed to be a Jeffersonian Democrat.
That had very specific meaning to him. Limited government, freedom for people, meaning white males. He was an egalitarian within the limits of those years.
Van Buren also shared Jackson's suspicion of bankers. In general, he believed no group, neither the government nor the wealthy, should have too much power, not even to help the economy. So Van Buren decided to continue Jackson's order. No government land could be bought with paper money. The American economy got worse. The president called a special meeting of Congress. In a message to lawmakers, Van Buren said, "Overbanking and overtrading had caused the Depression." He proposed several steps to protect the government. One of them was for Congress to pass a law permitting the government to keep its own money in the Treasury. America's Treasury Department received money when it collected import taxes and sold land. It used this money to pay what the government owed. The Treasury did not, however, hold the money from the time it was collected to the time it was paid out. The Treasury put the money in private banks. President Van Buren wanted to end this custom. He wanted a law to let the Treasury keep government money in its own secure places. The Whigs criticized Van Buren for thinking only of protecting the federal government and not helping businessmen, farmers, and the states. Some Democrats, who believed strongly in states' rights, also opposed Van Buren's idea. All these opponents provided enough votes in Congress to defeat the proposal. Van Buren tried again the following year to get approval for an independent Treasury. Again, the proposal was defeated. Finally, in June 1840, Congress passed a law enabling the Treasury Department to hold government money itself. Van Buren signed what was called the Independent Treasury Bill. But the economic depression continued. Martin Van Buren also faced an international challenge from a surprising place. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.